Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf, using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and our listeners will recall a couple weeks ago when I interviewed Mark Dunkelman, who's the author of a book entitled Why Nothing Worked. My guest today is author of a book that could have been titled Why Congress Doesn't Work or Why the U.S. Senate Doesn't Work. His focus is on the U.S. Senate and a peculiar procedure that I think everybody's heard of that has been weaponized to threaten our democracy. The book is called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. And the author is someone who should know this topic very well. His name is Adam Gentleson. He's a former top aide to Senator Harry Reid, who was both majority leader and minority leader, the Democrats. Adam also served as chief of staff to current Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania. Adam, hey, thanks a lot for taking the time. I know you're very busy.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a great history lesson in this book. It came out in 2021, and even somebody like me who teaches politics part-time, there's some interesting aspects of this, but let's start at the beginning for our listeners, just the role of debate in our new democracy, and everybody's familiar with how we compromise with a Senate giving states equal power in the House where the seats are apportioned. What was kind of the idea behind the role of debate in our legislature at the beginning?
Yeah, that's a great question and a great place to start. I mean, the idea behind debate in the beginning was that it should be free and open and very unstructured. And it's difficult to imagine now. If you flip on C-SPAN, you know, you'll often see an empty Senate floor, C-SPAN 2 if you're looking for the Senate. But back in the early days, the Senate floor was never empty because that's where the senators sat. They didn't have office buildings. They didn't really have much in the way of staff. They just would come to the Senate and they would sit at their desk on the Senate floor and they would consider whatever business was before the Senate and they would just talk about it, you know, almost like you and I are talking here. It was very, there's a lot of rules, but underlying the governance of the institution, but you know, those rules were just sort of not invoked very often because people just had free exchanges and would say what was on their mind. And then, you know, when they were done, the next person would talk. So it was a very collegial atmosphere, and that was the nature of debate. And so all of these obstructive measures that we're very familiar with today didn't really come about until much, much later, much later into the 18th century. Much later into the 1800s, into the 19th century. It was not until the middle of the 19th century that these obstructive tactics really started to make themselves felt.
You know, I wonder how many people, even people that have taken more advanced courses, would answer a question, true false question, properly on this notion of the filibuster, how whether it was part of our original vision of the founders or not, but.
I sort of alluded to this, but I mean, just to put a fine point on it, there was no filibuster in the early days. It was not in the original conception of the Senate. It is now these days sort of smuggled into the Senate rules. There's no rule that says the filibuster. they sort of pieced it together through some existing rules. But, you know, there was no, back in the early days, you would sort of talk until you were done talking and then the Senate would move on. There was no method by which the Senate could sort of bring business to a halt or make it stop altogether. That was considered beneath the dignity of senators, and it just wasn't done, and it certainly wasn't in the rules.
You do a great job in the book of talking about James Madison, one of our founders, and how the idea that, yes, we have a strong, robust debate, but it does come to an end at some point. And as you said, fast forward to the middle of the next century at all? What were the beginnings of this idea of limits, or I'm sorry, yeah, limits on debate and delay tactics and all? And who was behind that?
There were a lot of different tactics being experimented with during this time. It was really a a period of experimentation when it came to obstruction. But the main force that behind the specific development of the filibuster into eventually becoming what we know it today was the slave power and the oligarchy that supported slavery and benefited from it in the South. And their main advocate was Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, who had an interesting early career. Didn't really become the sort of tribune of the slave power until later on in his career. He was vice president for a while, and actually was an ally to Andrew Jackson and others. But then sort of settled back into the Senate and realized that he could really make a name for himself and gain a lot of power by being the foremost representative of the slave interests in the Senate. And he started to theorize and experiment with new methods of obstruction. And he was the first to really put down on paper and think through, in a theoretical way, this concept that senators were entitled to unlimited debate in a way that could hold up the business of the Senate. Now, there's an important distinction there because the idea of unlimited debate, this is a feature of the Senate, but what that was commonly understood to mean in the early days was that you could speak your mind and take all the time you wanted to get, whatever you need to get off your chest. It was never intended to be deployed in a way that would halt the business of the Senate or block things from moving forward for an indefinite period of time. You could block it for an hour or two, maybe a whole day, just to really, hold forth. But it was never intended to be something that could bring the business of the institution to a halt. And Calhoun started to sort of theorize that that was something that people could do. And what this led to was not the filibuster we know today in terms of there being a supermajority threshold that you have to clear for most business in the Senate. Even, I should say, because I don't think I mentioned this before, that everything that passed the Senate at this time was done on a majority rule vote. When people were done talking, the bill would come up, it would pass or fail on a majority vote. And so in Calhoun's time, what he pioneered was this sort of what we would refer to today as the talking filibuster, the sort of Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington version of standing on the Senate floor and speaking until you're exhausted. Now, even then, though, when you were done, the bill that was under consideration would come up for a majority vote. So even Calhoun himself didn't theorize or innovate any sort of higher threshold for things to pass the Senate. What he innovated was the sort of the talking filibuster and this idea of holding the floor as an obstructive measure to stop business from proceeding.
The historical life of the filibuster, what came next, and incorporate kind of the Rule 22 discussion. And again, I think this is important because if you ask most political science students, do we have majority rule in the United States? Most people think we do, but in a lot of ways, we really don't.
Yeah, and I think I'll frame up the development of Rule 22 to go back to the founders for a second, which is that, because you mentioned majority rule, it was very, very important to the founders that every vote that was taken, whether it was in the House or the Senate, be done on a majority rule basis. And they were very specific about this because they had experimented with what it means to raise the threshold for passage under the Articles of Confederation. Which was the system of government that was in place prior to during the American Revolution and prior to the Constitution being ratified. And under the Articles of Confederation, it was possible for a minority of senators, or it was a unicameral legislature, for a minority of people in the legislature to block a bill. And what this led to during the Revolution was levels of obstruction that made it impossible to conduct the war and to govern a country. And so they came out of that experience very, very clear in their own minds that it was important for there to be checks and balances. It was important for there to be unlimited debate. But at the end of the day, they did not want to give a minority the power to bring legislative business to a halt. And they wrote about this extensively in the Federalist Papers. There's lots of that in the book. I won't bore your readers with the quotes, but trust me when I say this was something they addressed directly and were extraordinarily clear that a minority should never be given the power to block a bill from moving forward. So what happened with Rule 22 was in 1917, President Woodrow Wilson asked the Congress to pass. There was unrestricted U-boat war, naval warfare going on in the Atlantic. German U-boats were threatening American merchant ships, and so President Wilson, this was in the lead up to World War I, President Wilson asked the Congress to pass a bill giving him the power to arm American merchant ships against the threat of attacks from German submarines. And the House, this was in the early part of the year, the House passed the bill very quickly, sends it over to the Senate. The Senate then filibusters it. A progressive senator, Robert La Follette from Wisconsin, who was an anti-war senator, saw this as, a lead into war, which was accurate. And he filibustered the bill for a couple days until the Senate adjourned, which scuttled the entire bill. This caused a major uproar because the public opinion was very much on the side of arming the American ships. And so there was this major outcry against this filibuster. Woodrow Wilson issued a statement decrying this. Is a famous phrase people might have heard of, where he said, it was a little group of willful men obstructing the nation's business. Major backlash from the public. We didn't have polls back then, so we don't know exactly what, but there was banner headline New York Times, and you could, without polls, you could sense that the public was outraged. And so senators certainly sensed that. And so they reconvened quickly a few days later, passed the bill, and then they formed a committee to study Senate rules and to give the chamber the power to end filibuster. So the backlash was so severe that the Senate decided, okay, we need to give ourselves a tool that we can use to end a filibuster if it's going on for too long. And again, this goes back to the idea of unlimited debate. The point at which the debate goes from a senator speaking his mind into the, overt attempt to disrupt and delay, that was the point where the Senate, under the idea formed by this committee, would then intervene and say, okay, that's enough. You've had your say. Now you're just trying to block business. And so what they did is they passed this thing called Rule 22. Just that was the order that it was entered onto the Senate rule books. And it gave a super majority of the Senate. At the time, it was 2/3. Today it's been lowered to 3/5. The power to vote to end debate. So if a senator was going on and on and on, 2/3 of the Senate could come together and vote. And this was not a vote to pass or fail the bill. It was simply a vote to say, you've been talking long enough, you need to stop. And then it would sort of a timer would start that would give them about another day. They still were generous about the time. But at the end of that timer, the senator would have to stop and sit down and the business would proceed. And ironically, this is the rule that today is used to impose the supermajority threshold on everything that passes the Senate. It's a very weedy explanation for how that came to be, but so my point here is that that's not what it was intended to be in the first place. What it really was intended to do was to be a tool that could end a talking filibuster on the rare occasion that that was needed. And that's the final point I want to make in this section of the history, which is that once this rule was on the book, it was very rarely used because senators continued to sort of proceed with the dynamic that had been prevalent for the entire history up to that point, which was to have a free and open debate, say what they wanted to say, and then when they were done speaking, they would let the bill come up for a vote. And 99% of bills continued to pass or fail on simple majority votes after the Senate had done its had had its say and conducted a robust debate.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and we're getting an interesting history lesson today on the U.S. Senate and specifically the filibuster up to this point in our interview with Adam Gentleson, who's author of a book called Kill Switch. It's really good. I really enjoyed reading this, and I learned some from it, and I teach political science part-time. The subtitle is The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Adam formerly served as a top aide to Senator Harry Reid and also John Fetterman. We're up to a point, where in pop modern culture we remember Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and then of course LBJ battling opponents of civil rights, and it just seemed like it was interesting to me how the filibuster has been closely associated for most of its life with opposing civil rights measures, up until, if we could, fast forward a little, till more modern times, when it's been used for all kinds of reasons. And basically now anything that passes out of the Senate has to get 60 votes. When you were there, kind of present at the creation, kind of, when did that start and what led to all that?
So I'll rewind a little bit because the
Okay.
civil rights piece is critical to how we got there, and I'll try to explain this briefly. But basically, once Rule 22 was on the books and said, two-thirds of the Senate, we have 100 senators now. Back then, there were fewer because Hawaii and Nevada or other states were not part of the union. So whatever, two-thirds of the Senate could come together and vote to move on today. So civil rights piece is critical here because the only bills that were consistently facing talking filibusters during this period of time were civil rights bills. Every other category of legislation would routinely, come up, people would talk about it, it would move on, it would pass or fail on a simple majority vote. Anything related to civil rights was guaranteed to face a filibuster from Southern senators. And depending on the year, there were usually around 20 senators representing Southern states in the Senate at the time. So what they would do is they would coordinate amongst themselves and they would just pass the baton back and forth for talking on the floor. So, they could keep it going indefinitely. It wasn't just one man talking, until he tired out. They could tag team it to keep it going for, endlessly. And they would. They were very disciplined about it, and they practiced a lot, and they would do this anytime a civil rights bill came over. So what happened is it became sort of standard practice that civil rights bills required a supermajority to pass, because unlike other bills, you knew they were going to face a filibuster, and to end a filibuster, you had to use Rule 22, and Rule 22 required two-thirds vote to end debate and move on. So it just became sort of accepted in the Senate that a civil rights bill would require a supermajority, because everybody knew it would face a filibuster, and to end the filibuster, you had to have a supermajority vote to invoke Rule 22. So you have this two-tiered system developed where every other category of legislation passed or failed on a majority vote. Civil rights de facto had to pass on a supermajority threshold because it was going to face a filibuster. So fast forward to today, basically what we've done is we have applied that same standard that previously during the Jim Crow era was only applied to civil rights bills. Today we apply that to every bill. So it is accepted that any bill that comes to the floor is going to face a quote unquote filibuster. And I use quotes intentionally, and I'll explain why in a second. And to overcome that quote unquote filibuster, you have to invoke Rule 22 and vote to end debate. And what's interesting about this is that, technically, every bill in the Senate still, when it at the final vote, is a simple majority threshold, pass or fail, 50 votes, 51 votes to pass. It is where the bills get held up is this procedural vote that comes before the final passage, where you have to apply the supermajority standard. And so that's become, that is obviously a higher hurdle. And so that becomes the de facto passage vote. And so, when you mentioned being there at the creations, it steadily got more common starting the 1970s and the 80s for bills to, face filibusters and have to pass or, have to have Rule 22 invoked and have to clear a supermajority threshold. But it was still, every Senate session is 2 years. If you look at the numbers, it's somewhere in like the 40s or the 60s, the number of times that supermajority threshold would have to be invoked in a 2-year period. So, much more common, but not a ton. When Mitch McConnell, from the senator from Kentucky, became the Senate minority leader in 2007, Democrats in the 2006 midterms, they took back the Senate majority. This was under President George W. Bush. My former boss, Harry Reid, became the majority leader, and Mitch McConnell replaced a senator from Tennessee named Bill Frist as the Republican leader. Mitch McConnell started to use the filibuster more than had ever been used before. So in 2007, we're still operating under President Bush. It's not used a ton because Republicans are in the minority. They're in the same party as the president. When Barack Obama is elected president and he takes office in 2009, McConnell is still in the minority and he begins to deploy the filibuster against literally everything the president does. And so when you look at the numbers, that's when they skyrocket from in the neighborhood of the 60s to 120, 140. They basically double from 1 year to the next. And that is because Mitch McConnell has started to apply this obstructive tool to everything we were trying to do in the Senate. And I mean everything, not just the big ticket legislation, but routine Senate business, everything had to overcome this hurdle. And so that is what has led to the institution being completely ground to a halt by this rule that did not exist in the first place, was not part of the founders' conception of the Senate, evolved over time, and today is used to bring the Senate to a grinding halt on basically anything it tries to do.
I remember that period very well because Democrats were pretty excited when Obama won and had control of both houses and got to get a lot of things done. But it was hard to explain to people that, well, you need 60 votes. And when Ted Kennedy died and that special election went the other way, I remember then things did become more difficult to pass. And as your subtitle says, the crippling of American democracy, it does lead to frustration that things don't get done. And as I said in the introduction, this is kind of why Congress doesn't work. Is again, the key point you make is as it was originally intended in the Senate, as in the House. But if I could switch gears for a minute, Adam, because you're involved in something interesting here too. And again, I highly recommend the book. Tell us if you would. Well, first of all, you're writing a new book. Tell us about your new book, but also about this new venture you're involved in called the Searchlight Institute, if you would, please.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, so the new book is called Supermajority, and it's sort of an answer to the first book. And the first book is about how, through these changes in Senate history and procedure, we unintentionally gave a minority of senators in one chamber of Congress the power to block any bill that comes before Congress. And we basically put ourselves in a position of being victims of minority in this country. This new book, Supermajority, is about how we overcome that, how we can craft a broad-based appeal across Democrats, Independents, and Republicans to build public support for a supermajority of Americans who would come together to overcome minority rule and try to make this country work again. And the thesis is that we need to get outside of the boxes and break this binary perception of politics that's really crippled us, in my opinion, of left versus right, Democrats versus Republicans. And both sides have sort of receded into their corners. We've become extremely rigid about enforcing ideological commitments. I'm coming at this. I'm more focused on the left side of the spectrum as a Democrat, as a liberal. I see my side getting very rigid about demanding, that people adhere to a long litany of ideological commitments in order to be considered a liberal in good standing. And I think we need to get away from that. I think we need to be more pluralistic. Pluralism is a core liberal value. We need to be more accepting of people with different views. And frankly, that allows us to think bigger about how we can conduct our politics. And so the book goes back through, it sort of starts with a retracing of more recent history, sort of starting in 2000, how we got to where we are, to this very polarized 50-50 state. And then it goes back through some historical periods to look at how we were able to build supermajority consensus in the past, the New Deal, the Civil Rights era, and what lessons we can draw from those eras. So that's what we're doing. That's what the book is. And then the Searchlight Institute is a new policy think tank that is designed to sort of put those ideas into practice, to develop some of those ideas that can achieve broad consensus, put them out into the world, and try to build support for them.
Well, I've got about just a minute or two left, and I think from your perspective as working for two senators who are from only seven of the battleground states that are left. When I started teaching, there were 18 back in 2000. But anyway, I got about 2 minutes. If you could just, what are your thoughts on, Democrats are going through a rough period here of introspection and trying to get back on their feet after the loss in 24. What's your thoughts on this? I mean, it's that there's a lot of competing voices. How the Democrats are going to get things back together?
Yeah, I think it's really going to require people to step outside of their comfort zone and to stop being so committed to these positions that are just not in touch with the American people. I think people need to be free to speak their minds. I think we need to be more welcoming. When I talk about it, I say, look, to me, the dominant paradigm among Democrats and liberals right now is fear. We've become very afraid. For understandable reasons, it's a dangerous world out there these days, but we've become afraid of each other. We've become afraid of the American people. We've become afraid of anybody who holds slightly different views from our own principles. And I think we need to overcome that, and we need to reach out across ideological boundaries. We need to be more accepting of people who hold different views, and continue to fight for what you believe in by all means, but invite people into the big tent. So my short answer to your question is Democrats need to build a big tent. That's the only way we're going to get out of this mess, and it's going to require some more acceptance of people who don't agree with us on every single issue.
Well, I look forward to your new book because I think this book we've been discussing today is excellent. And again, for our listeners, it's called Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Very relevant to our times. Adam Gentleson has been my guest. He's the author, and he'll be coming out with a new book called Super Majority. And he's also with the Searchlight Institute, which I think is an effort again to build bigger coalitions, bigger groups together, and kind of help overcome this partisan divide, which is really hurting our country. Regardless of where you're at on the partisan divide, I think it's clearly not a good thing. Adam, thank you so much, and I hope wish you luck, and hope to have you back to talk about your new book at some point.
I love that very much. Thank you, Robin.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.